This is Secrets to Win Big, your roadmap to sustained growth. Brought to you by Arjun Sen, founder and CEO of Zen Mango, top brand growth driver and a former Fortune 500 executive who has been called one of the most marketing intelligent minds in the business. Find him at zenmango.com. And now, here's your host, Arjun Sen.
Welcome to Secrets to Win Big with Arjun Sen. Hi, I'm Arjun. And to me, I thrive talking to leaders from all walks of life, all over the world, because the journey to winning does not have one path. There are different paths. Today, it's truly my honor to work with and have a conversation with my VIP guest, Howard Tiersky. Howard is the author of the Wall Street Journal best-selling book, Winning Digital Customers. And the word winning really got me excited. The antidote to irrelevance. And I really think there's so much stories hidden there. I really want to get into and learn about this book and why he chose to position this way. He's also the founder of digital transformation agency From, which has won over 100 awards for user experience design and helped redesign the Avis app, which is now ranked J.D. Power's number one in the industry. In his 25 years career, helping large enterprises win in the digital space, Howard has worked on projects for dozens of Fortune 1000 companies and has been named one of the top 10 digital transformation influencers by IDG as well as Enterprise 360. Welcome to Secrets to Win Big, Howard. Truly a pleasure.
Thank you, Arjun. Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So Howard, first let's talk about the book. What's the book all about? What was the whole thing about referring to irrelevance?
Well, the world has changed a lot in the last 20 years. And it's perhaps changed as much in the last 2 years as maybe some of those 20 years put together. So we've seen a lot of transformation in the world. And the number one thing that's driving that is digital. The way that we're all adapted to a model of our smartphones being kind of the center of our worlds. Studies show that 70% of people sleep with their smartphones on the side of their bed. And when asked whether they'd be willing to give up their smartphone, if they had to choose between giving up their smartphone and giving up vacation or giving up something important to them, people almost always pick the smartphone. So that's a big change in the world and in customers and in the way we live, the way we bank, the way we shop, the way we connect with our friends, the way we plan travel, the way we do nearly everything. And so what that means is that brands that are looking to be preferred by those customers, they need to be changing too, because if the world changes and your customers change and you don't change as a company, as a brand, it's highly likely that you're going to become less and less relevant to those customers over time. And sadly, we've seen many brands over the last number of years that have gone out of business, once great brands, whether it's Sears, Toys R Us, Circuit City, and on and on. And in most cases, and there's always complex, multiple reasons why any one company goes out of business. But what we see most commonly is that they simply fell out of step with what their customers really wanted and needed as their customers' needs changed. And so the book is really all about, so what do you do about that? As a brand, how do you plot a course? How do you understand where your customers are now and where they're going? How do you understand the journey and the experience you're giving them today and create a vision for what that should be in the future? And then how do you get there? And what are all the problems you're likely to face along the way and how do you overcome them?
I love that. And I just want to build on the clear vision. But before that, I want to repeat two things you said because I'm just writing as fast as I could. The first thing that really hit me was path to being preferred is being in the mind of the customers, as in their mind. And second is falling out of step with your customers. I really could relate to that because the moment you fall behind, it's very tough to catch up. So now let's go into the concept of vision. You know, for every journey, there has to be clear vision. I have not met a single company who says we don't care about customers. So how do you connect the vision to staying truly with your customers and stay ahead in the journey?
Yeah, well, you're right. Every company is going to say they care about their customers. But I think that a lot of companies have an idea about who their customers are and what their customers want and care about. And sometimes those ideas are wrong or are out of date. And especially now, because customers have changed so much. COVID has really been this once in a century transformational force that's changed our priorities, changed our desires, changed our fears, changed our behaviors, changed our habits. And so I think that the first step, and in my book, this is the first step of my five steps of digital transformation, is to truly understand the customer. And how you do that is mainly through research to figure out what is it that you really need to understand about your customer. What is their experience with the brand today? What are the priorities they have in selecting a provider in whatever category you are, whether you're a bank or a pet store or whatnot? What are their priorities? What draws them towards some brands? What pushes them away from other brands? And understanding what ultimately drives their behavior. You know, one of the things I like to say is this idea of being customer-centric is a key part of what I talk about in the book. And I really believe it's the key to success in any business, the number one key. And so many customers, of course, so many companies, of course, say they care about the customer, but don't necessarily operate in a truly customer-centric way. And you know, the bottom line is that success in business is mostly, not exclusively, but mostly about successfully driving the behavior of your customers or your prospective customers. If you can get the customers to do what you want, you're going to be running a great business. Even if your, you know, warehouse inventory system isn't the best and your accounting system could use some improvement, or, I mean, there are other things, right? But that's the key to a success. And if, by the way, if you're not successfully driving your customer's behavior, then, you know, a whole bunch of other things you're going to be doing right maybe aren't going to help. Your legal department can be the best in the world, you know, but if you're not successfully able to influence your customers. So therefore, the most number one priority of any business should be to ask the question, how can I most effectively influence and drive the behavior of my customers? And the number one step to doing that, to influencing anybody, is first and foremost to understand them. If you want to get someone to do something, you have to understand where they're coming from first and foremost. And a lot of companies have these sometimes stale ideas about who their customers are, what their customers value, and those need to be refreshed. And the way to do it is to research. And in the book, I spend quite a bit of the book talking about a wide range of research techniques, from surveying to ethnography to interviewing to data analysis to social monitoring, sentiment analysis, call center observation, and on and on and on. And the reason I spend so much time on that and go into so much detail is because that's where the gold is. And there are so many proven methods to do this kind of research that companies often aren't leveraging or aren't leveraging enough.
You know, I have to digress and go into a side of research is I see a lot of companies spend obscene amount of money doing these segmentation work. And then they name these segments, which sound incredibly fascinating when I sit in this conference room, which is really intellectual, very cute, but I cannot connect with that segment. I do not know what it means. So what's the trap that people fall in when they do this research? Anything you can help us on segmentation or anything to get to know customers?
Sure. Well, look, research has to then be made actionable. And yes, I think there are some companies that fail to conduct enough research. There are also companies that conduct a lot of research, but it doesn't make its way into the hands and into the minds of the people that really need to use it. And so the question about, you know, if you have a research department and they engage a big research company and you wind up with a 600-page PowerPoint presentation, are the people who are developing your app, are they reading that? Are they understanding it? Is it meaningful to them? Are the people that are designing your new stores, that are creating your new products, that are working on your pricing model, are they digesting that information in a way that's meaningful to them? Because if not, it's just intellectual academic stuff that's not helping your business. And so there are a variety of things that we recommend to do. First of all, creating personas for individual segments so that you can bring those segments to life through fictional characters, something short, something visual, like infographics that show we have these six types of customers. And this is one type. They're, you know, a budget-minded traveler or whatever. And they have, you know, very often their families, they only take one trip a year. They have to make their dollar stretch as far as possible. They love deals, you know, and, you know, et cetera. And that this is one type of customer that we're designing for. And another type of customer is the luxury traveler for whom cost is no object. What they really want is the best service, the best quality experience. They consider their time much more valuable than their money. Well, creating a great experience for those two different personas is of course quite different. And if you can bring and to create an actual character, you get an image and say, this is Bob. He's our luxury minded consumer. Or he's at least an example of that. And here's a little bit about him. Here's his profile. He's retired now. He was a banker. You know, he makes his investments pay him $600,000 a year. He likes to spend at least $100,000 a year on travel, et cetera, et cetera. So you bring these to life. That's still very high level, right? It's not nearly as detailed and as rich as your complete body of research, but you have at least enabled everybody, hopefully, who's working on customer facing stuff to have that high level understanding. And then the question is, how do you go to the next level to make sure that that insight is utilized in creating the vision for the customer journey and communicating the vision? Things like workshops, and even just making sure resources are available so that if somebody's working on a product, instead of just handing them the 600 slide PowerPoint presentation, you've got people whose job it is to engage with those people and say, here's what we know about the customer. Here's how it can help you. And in addition, and I'll mention just one or two other quick things. There are so many. Making sure that the people who are actually creating and making the decisions about the customer experience have some opportunity to participate in research. That is really, really valuable. And if you're going to go out and interview, you know, 200 customers, grab a couple of marketing people, grab a couple of developers, grab a couple of product development people, let them sit behind the one-way mirror, or let them come along if you're standing behind the counter at the bank, observing customer interactions or whatever type of research you're doing. Let them spend a couple days doing nothing but observing customers, or have them listen to call center recordings. Immerse them in the experience of the customer, because even a small amount of that goes a long way. You know, the data that you mentioned is one thing, but it can be dry. It can be difficult for people to internalize it. When they spend some time directly with customers, that's another way to make sure that they have that empathy, they have that insight, they can draw on really some of that understanding of who the customer is. So those are some of the things. There's many, many more things, but making sure ultimately, oh, and I'll just mention one last thing, which is, you know, ultimately creating journey maps. So, you know, in the book, we talk about the steps. First is to understand the customer. The second is to map the journey. So once, you know, you have some team of people who are diving into all that customer insight and turning that into a vision of what should be the customer experience we're delivering. And that journey can be expressed. And now this isn't so much about expressing research as it is expressing a vision, but that vision can be expressed as a story. This is what should happen to the customer when they walk into the store, when they pick up something they're interested in, when we're discussing possibly purchasing it, when we're talking about financing, when we're sending them the product, when they go home, when they have a problem or a question. We've mapped out a vision of what that experience should be and articulated it as a story, because stories are something people can digest. Stories are things that people remember. To go back to your question, if I show you a very complex segment analysis that breaks customers into 600 different cells, and you have all this math and charts and graphs, that's really good stuff. But for a lot of ordinary product managers or marketers or other people that might need to actually use that information, it can be hard to digest. But if you create a story that says, this is the future we're trying to create, and then you create a personas that say, these are the people we're creating it for, that's the sort of thing that everybody should be able to digest and remember and use on a day-to-day basis.
That's brilliant. So you really helped me. The next step I was trying to get to was, after you understand the customer, how you do that and take it to action. And I love the way you included every member of the team, even beyond marketing, from day one. So that way the goal is, as you mentioned, is get actionable research into the hands of every stakeholder or person who will use it, because that's the use. So now let's, you know, take the conversation a little in a bigger area, because not only you are an expert in these areas, but you also have built big teams in corporate, and also now making these impacts that you're doing doesn't happen individually. So what's your secret to building a team and getting everybody to align with Howard's vision as you take the team across the finish line?
Well, let me start by saying it starts by finding the right people who share common values around, obviously they have to have the right skills, but they also have to share the common values and a desire to approach whatever it is. Let's say it's product development in a customer-centric and a user-centric way, so that we don't have to convince all of these people. We've assembled a team that already shares those values at the beginning. That's super, super valuable. That puts you already way past the starting line. And then, you know, the second thing is, and part of one of those values, I think there's a few key values that underlie the idea of being customer-centric. And I'll tell you the two most important ones. One is curiosity and one is empathy. The desire to really, and part of curiosity is humility. It's being able to say, yeah, you know, it's very difficult to actually understand another human being, to understand what's driving them, to understand what is causing them. I mean, let's be honest. How many of us really even understand ourselves all that well and can truly honestly explain why we do some of the things we do of ourselves? So start with the humility to recognize that it's very difficult to truly understand your customer. Anyone who has the mindset of, oh yeah, you know, I know this customer. We've worked with this customer for years. We understand them cold. Almost inevitably, that person is way off base, because that mindset is not a mindset of humility. Because again, like I said earlier, the customer is constantly changing. But the desire to say, I really want to know this customer better. They probably will surprise me in a variety of ways. And I'm really curious to learn what I can learn. Because the other thing that happens is, if you think you know the answer, you'll find it. You know, if you think that your older customers aren't interested in using the app and you have that idea in your head and you go out, I bet you you'll come back with some data that supports it. And on the other hand, if you go out with a mindset that says, I really don't know, I'm just really curious to find out the answer, depending on what the truth is, you might come out with an answer that doesn't support that at all. And so that is perhaps the most important component. And then empathy is about, like, not judging. In other words, it kind of goes to that same idea of really desiring to understand people and loving them, you know, even if they're different from you, and saying, this person is awesome. These users are great. How can I find a better way to serve them? Instead of sometimes an attitude that says, oh, these people are idiots. They should understand why my product is great. Or, you know, they never seem to be able to understand how anything works, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think those are some of the key sort of cultural components. And then what was the question? How to assemble the team? You know, I think the last thing I'd say about it is, you know, I think there's a Steve Jobs quote that's like, you know, the best way to manage is don't tell people what to do, assemble smart people and just give them a goal. And I think you mentioned, how do you get the team on the Howard Tiersky, you know, way of approaching things. I think, you know, maybe that's the wrong way of thinking about it. And instead, the real question is, again, if you assemble people with the right culture and right mindset, and then you say, what we're trying to do is create, you know, a better digital camera for nature enthusiasts. How are we going to do that? How are we going to accomplish that? That's the goal, right? We want to create a better camera that they're going to be willing to pay more for, that more nature enthusiasts are going to buy. So we got to give them that. You know, usually teams are given some sort of objective. Now, how are we going to accomplish that? And see what the team comes back with. Because if you hire the right people, you probably get a better outcome if you give them the freedom to figure that out, then if you try to get them to get on board with what, say, the leader is thinking.
And, you know, to me, I really connect to that is, individuals should have a say on the how, and that makes the solution diverse. My wife and myself, we have a very simple rule. She can tell me what to do, when to do, but she also tells me how to do. I never do it. Okay. Because to me, in that case, you really don't need me. Because I really want to have little fun doing it my way. And yeah, I love that. But connecting on the common goals, so all of us know where we are going, and then, you know, going forward. Yeah. You're talking about leaders, and you talked about Steve Jobs. Is there anybody that you can talk about is one of the best leaders you've ever worked with? And more importantly, what makes that person inspiring to you?
It's a good question. I think, you know, to go back to the same theme, I mean, I remember, I worked in a communications department at Ernst & Young, and there was a guy named Don Howarth, who was the leader of that organization. And he was, what I thought was great about him was he set a clear standard. He was running a communications department that was probably delivering work at a level way beyond what a typical corporate communications department would deliver. And that was, you know, I was just a kid at the time. So that wasn't me causing that. That was the operation he was running. So he had a clear sense of what the standards were. But he gave everyone a tremendous amount of latitude and freedom. And also, he really gave him his confidence. You know, I remember as a kid, you know, I was in my 20s, and he would pull me aside and he would tell me how great he thought I was and how he thought I was ready to take on all these additional responsibilities and things like that. And so then I did. I said, oh, well, okay. And only much later did I realize, you know, I thought I was so special, right? He thinks I'm so great. Only later did I realize he did that with everybody. You know, he would, and it wasn't that he was being insincere. First of all, he was selective about who he put on his team. But second of all, he found what those people were great at and what deserved genuine praise. Mm-hmm. And I think he felt like one of his number one jobs was to make sure he was going around finding really good reasons to praise each person on the team. And, you know, I mean, that is the kind of thing that makes people want to work hard, want to grow, when they feel that they're working for somebody who really believes in them and believes in their potential. And it may seem obvious in a way, but I don't think 90% of bosses do that. You know, they may believe in people who work for them, but then they start to get doubts, they start to get uncertain, and they start to want to tell people what to do, just like your wife. And because, well, again, it goes back to humility, right? Do you think you know better than your employees? Maybe you do, but if you take that approach, you're probably not going to get the results versus having the humility to say, we might get a better outcome if I let them do it the way that they think is best, even if it's not what I would naturally do. And that also requires like that sense of humility. And I think that that's one facet of great leadership.
I think that also gives the team ownership. Instead of you being my boss, me doing things your way. When we are doing things my way, it makes me go above and beyond to work there. And, you know, I want to connect a few dots is in the previous conversation, earlier part, you talked about the goal. And then you're talking about as you are, you know, being the cheerleader. Talking to quite a few CEOs, I found that these are the four key areas of a CEO's job. One is the goal. Not only do you see it, you have to help everybody from their position to see and see paths, which are very different. The second is you as a boss, you have to come in and break barriers for me. Sometimes I don't be able to, and you being able to break the barriers makes it so much easier because you have a bigger hammer. Third is bring resources, which comes after. And number four is, as you talked about, purposeful cheerleading, which is not coming and saying, Arjun, you're doing good. I'm like, oh, sure, boss. Yeah. No, Arjun, you're doing good because, like, that is the part I really love. And I think that was great.
Yeah, so, I agree.
You have had an amazing career. And even cooler days are ahead. If there's only one piece of learning you can take to the amazing journey ahead, what is the one piece, only one, that you would take ahead?
Well, you know, it's so similar to what I said before, but I think the number one learning is really understanding the customer or whoever you're creating something for. You know, sometimes it's the employee who you're creating a system for, but really understanding them is the key to almost all success. And that's not how most things are done. And so if you're keying in on that, you're way ahead of most of your competitors.
Love that. And Howard, my recommendation would be that the next book by Howard is Never Fly Customer Blind. I can see that's, I love that. I really love that. But again, you know, just wanted to be
looking. Yeah, yeah. So well, I'd like to think that's what this book is. You know? Actually, the next book I'm writing is about the idea of digital humanity. What is it that makes an experience feel personal and human? Mm-hmm. And how possible is it to create digital experiences that scratch the itch so that people don't feel like they need to speak to a human being? And also, how do you make even person-to-person experiences scratch the itch to feel human? Because we've all had experiences to go to the, say, the Department of Motor Vehicles, and speak to a person and feel like we're speaking to an a robot. Totally. And of course, there can be digital experiences that are rich with a feeling of personalization and humanity. So that's the next book that I'm working on right now.
Yeah, and you know, you and I should talk, because for me, my consulting is based on a core IP, which is we are all in the feeling business. Okay. And there are 8 words we live by: is be human, think human, feel human, and then act human. Because as you talked about, it connects to everything you have said. Is I cannot tomorrow, if I want to market to you, I cannot just pull your profile and start selling to you. I really need to spend time to be on your shoes, look at your journey, and create a story around it, and then talk about it. So changing the conversation a little bit, taking it personal, just to have a little fun. Let's say Howard walks into a restaurant or a coffee shop or a bar or a coffee shop and meets 16-year-old Howard and 100-year-old Howard. And of course, you are there. What would the conversation look like that day?
Man, oh man, these are some tough questions. I'm not sure I'd say anything to 16-year-old Howard. I think I'd be worried about like Star Trek, you know, I'd be worried about like messing with the space-time continuum or something. I think I would just observe. I think I'd be very amused to see 16-year-old Howard and what he's thinking and doing. 100-year-old Howard, I think I'd want to just know how my kids are doing. That's the biggest project in my life. You know, none of this stuff I do for any of these brands is as important as the project of my 5 kids. So I think I'd say to 100-year Howard, how's Foster? How's Rachel? You know, how's Jessica? How's Samantha? And how's Joseph?
Well, thank you. So Howard, this has been a fascinating conversation. So before we wrap up, is there anything else we haven't talked about you want to add? You have also answered every question, which means if you want to ask me something, I would love to try to answer. So any thoughts, your final thoughts or a question?
Oh man, I get to ask you a question. All right. Well, we would talk, you know, I know your podcast is Secrets to Win Big. So what do you think is the number one secret to win big? And if it's the same one I just said, then tell me your number two secret. Other than understanding the customer, what do you think is a secret to win big?
Yeah, you know, to me, I would start with the premise that any company has one or two paths to a billion-dollar big win idea. Every company has that. But the challenge is we are not focused. We work on so many different things, get distracted so easily. And that's the part where my biggest thing I have worked with, anytime I see with work with brands, it's the one thing. I'll give you a simple example. We started working with a restaurant chain, one unit called Icon Burger. They had amazing resources. And I told them day one, they didn't like me when I said, the world doesn't need another burger place till you tell me why you need a seat at my table. Mm-hmm. And as we started going through, we realized that they take every burger, they smash it. And smashing makes the juice come out, okay? So all we realized was the name is Smash Burger. That's your path. That's the quarterback. That's the running back. That's the guy. Just do not lose that and move forward. And that's the part where what happens is anytime you get a new marketing guy come in, they want to create a new path. But I really think for every brand, there is one or two paths to win big. Staying focused, and sometimes is a blue collar job, not a white collar, creativity always. You have to do the grunt work to keep going through. And that is my simple thought. That is
very interesting. Well, I have a Smash Burger right near me, and I never knew why they were called Smash Burger. So that's very interesting.
Yeah, because smashing makes the juice come out, and it's a better process. Like that's, if they keep communicating that, why will you not have a better burger instead of that? So
right, interesting, huh? Well, yeah, that's fascinating. And what was I going to say? Well, anyway, yeah, I love that.
Thank you. So Howard, this has been fascinating. I truly love that. And what I really loved in our conversation today is not what the brilliant content you brought. You brought it with passion. Like you shared it with the passion of a person who is living this, a leader. And you connecting it to your 5 kids really connected that how you're living as one authentic human being. And the biggest project is your 5 kids. I really love that part. Being a dad, I really felt as a dad to dad, that's the moment I felt Howard rocks. So I really wish you the very best. Thank you for taking time today. This was a great conversation.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Secrets to Win Big with Arjun Sen, founder and CEO of Zen Mango, top brand growth driver and a former Fortune 500 executive who has been called one of the most marketing intelligent minds in the business. To learn more, visit www.zenmango.com. Share this podcast with your friends and subscribe wherever you like to listen to podcasts. This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.